evocative descriptions of exotic places that are going to transport us out of Knoxville. Nail-biting cliffhangers and suspense. Genuinely hilarious humour. A deep irony. A dramatic reversals of fortune as the tables are suddenly turned. An inspiringly strong woman, beautiful and smart and courageous in equal measure. Intoxicating romance. The shadow of catastrophic genocidal doom hanging over a nation. A villain who is profoundly, disturbingly sadistic and evil. Incredibly satisfying poetic justice and a happy ending. So these are just some of the things we have to look forward to, guys, over the next 10 weeks as we feast on the amazing tale of the Old Testament book of Esther. And we'll dive into the book in a second. First, just let me give us a quick heads up to orientate us regarding some of the main themes that we've got to look forward to. There are three big ones I want to highlight at the outset. And the first is God's providence. In other words, the reality that God is always at work, orchestrating events behind the scenes, working things out, causing coincidences to happen. In all 10 chapters of Esther, guess how many times God appears or was mentioned? And you probably know from the fact I'm asking that what the surprising answer is. And you're right, it's that many. On the surface, God is utterly absent. There are no miracles, no prophecies, no apparent evidence of God at all. No one ever prays to him or even mentions him or even apparently thinks of him. And that's deliberate and incredibly clever by the author. It's teaching us that even when God is invisible, even when he seems utterly absent from our lives, even when everything seems to be unraveling and coming undone and going off the rails, have you ever had that in your life? Everything seems to be imploding. He's still in control, working behind the scenes, working all things for the good of those who love him. So first of all, get ready for some profound, encouraging insights into this thing we call God's providence. Second, there's the theme of human responsibility. And we will get into the meat and the verses in a sec, don't worry. But it's good to set the stage so we can spot things when they pop out of this as the author means them to. Secondly, human responsibility. Because yes, God is sovereign. This is also a story about amazing, inspiring human initiative and skill and courage and smart planning and boldness and being decisive and taking action. And by the way, all the way through the Bible, the two go hand in hand. Total divine sovereignty and yet at the same time real human responsibility, as we'll see in Esther. And then third, we're going to see the theme of this is unusual and kind of interesting, the absurdity of wickedness. I wonder if you've ever thought of wickedness as being fundamentally absurd, ridiculous. Wickedness and evil in this story are made to look really, really stupid. And actually, it's very, very funny in parts. And we're invited, as readers, to laugh along too. God laughs at the wicked in Psalm 2. Sometimes that is a good thing for us to do, to choose to laugh in its face instead of being intimidated by it. And Esther's going to show us how. I don't know if we do that enough. So there's a quick trailer for the book. There's a quick heads up for some of the main themes. Let's dive in. Esther opens in the mid-400s BC. In other words, while God's people are in exile, scattered throughout the massive, mighty superpower empire of the Persians. And that's important. We need to know that. That'll come back later. But God's people are in exile. So please look up Esther chapter 1. We're doing the whole of chapter 1 this morning. It's page 382 in the church Bibles. Page 382, Esther chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. It'll appear on the screens, but it's good for you to have it open, so as we go through and pick different things out of the verses, you can check up on me. Check I'm just being a faithful messenger, not sharing my own ideas. Esther chapter 1, verse 1. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, and I've got to say, okay, so I did a sermon series on Nehemiah in Providence, and we made great play of the fact that the Hebrew way of pronouncing Nehemiah is Nehemiah. Well, the way of pronouncing Ahasuerus in the Hebrew is Ahasuerus. I'm not saying Ahasuerus, okay? Let's just get that out there. Let's keep it simple and say it as it sounds in English, which is still a little tricky, so have mercy on me if I mess it up. But now in the days of Ahasuerus, a.k.a. Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all of his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict. There's no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mayuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zithar, and Carcass, the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshina, Shetha, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, the 7 princes of Persian Media who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti? Because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs. Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media, who have heard of the queen's behavior, will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people, and be master in his own household, and speak according to the language of his people. Father God, thank you for this amazing, colourful, rich tale. Help us to understand it rightly. Help us to see it in the context of your word. Would your spirit make the profound spiritual realities in this tale spring to life so that we get to be blessed by them as we faithfully live them, live in the light of them, all for your glory. Help us to focus now and suck this dry of the goodness and truth, as well as the humour and the other insights that you have for us this morning. Jesus Christ, the living word. Amen. I've got two simple points this morning. Here's the first. An apparently powerful kingdom. An apparently powerful kingdom. What we're meant to see here, first of all, is this apparent power. It's a power play of the mighty Medo-Persian Empire. And this is in verses 1 to 9, point 1. So verse 1, the author wants us to know that the kingdom goes all the way from India to Ethiopia. That is 127 territories. That is many nations. And the king of this insanely powerful, wealthy kingdom throws a party. Why? Answer verse 4. To show off the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days, 6 months. Has anyone here ever been to a party? That would be something, wouldn't it? And all the generals and rulers and politicians and officials and anyone of any serious power is there. And at the end of it, there is a special week-long feast. Like, how does that even work? I guess they had to sleep and take breaks from eating. I think the picture is unlimited mountains of delicacies from all over the empire. You know, exotic fruits that many of the people at the feast would never have heard of or seen or even knew existed. Pineapples, passion fruits, different types of meats, again, that would have been totally new to so many people in the party. Maybe they were eating zebra, I don't know. Giraffe. Amazing sauces and flavors. I bet the Indians were good at that, with the spices and the curries that people from Ethiopia were like, this is making my head explode. Magnificent cakes, desserts that would just melt in your mouth. It was basically an all-you-can-eat luxury buffet for a week. And in verse 6, we see that throughout this week-long feast, they're surrounded by the most breathtakingly beautiful, expensive luxury available on the planet at the time. The gold and silver, all kinds of precious stones, marble pillars, fine linen, all the most expensive colors. Verse 7, the wine is flowing, it's unlimited. And this isn't any old cheap stuff. This is the royal wine, the most exquisite drink available in the empire, probably on the earth. Matured in special barrels for years, I would imagine. Now, there is one rule about the drinking. Verse 8, they make an edict, a rule. You know what the rule is? The rule is that there are no rules. There is no compulsion. In other words, you're not constricted at this party to drinking only when the king drinks. That was normally the convention. No, no, no. This time, you drink as much as and whenever you like. And there's even another feast going on at the same time for the ladies, for you ladies, in verse 9. So what do we have here? What we have here is the global pinnacle of military power, verse 3, political power, financial power, legal power, exquisite culture, unrestrained pleasure. And if you remember the context for this that we said at the beginning, this is the epicenter of the pagan empire in which God's people have been scattered. They're in exile. So they're weak. They're vulnerable. To be frank, by comparison to this, that we've just seen in verses 1 to 9, they are pretty pathetic. They have none of the above. They've lost everything in terms of their homeland, their nation. And they must have looked up at this seemingly limitless power and luxury and wealth and success towering over them and thought, is it really worth staying faithful to the one true God? Is it worth taking our stand, being the odd ones out, being the underdogs? Look, we're never going to get away from the power of this empire. Look at it. Look at verses 1 to 9. So why not just change teams? Why not start backing the winner? God doesn't seem to be coming through for us. Why not just go with the flow and live for this world? At least then we would be backing the obvious apparent winner. That's what God's people must have been tempted to think. And so my question is this. Is that sometimes how we are tempted to think? 1 Peter 2:11 describes us Christians as being strangers in this world, in exile. We're in exile, just like they were. We're away from our home. Romans 12:2 warns us not to conform to this world, not to go with the flow, not to live for this world instead of living for Christ. Which raises the question, well, why not? Isn't the glory and the opulence and the luxury and the fulfillment and the dreams come true, verses 1 to 9, worth it? Why not conform to this world? And one answer, the Bible has multiple answers. One of the big ones is that actually this world is going down. This world is going down. All of that wealth and banqueting and power we read about just now, do you remember which city is that happening in? Just have a look down. Which city? I'll give you a clue. Verse 5. Do you see? Susa, the magnificent capital of this empire. Guess how Susa's doing now? Today, Susa is a deserted mudflat. It's just dust. Like, what a perfect metaphor. Now listen to these amazing verses from Isaiah 40. It is he, the Lord, who sits above the circle of the earth. The whole of the planet's just a circle to God. And its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who brings princes to nothing and makes rulers of the earth as emptiness. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely has their stem taken root in the earth, when he blows on them and they wither, and the tempest carries them off like stubble. Psalm 2 says that when the nations of the earth come together, even in the form of 127 territories, maybe, and they look so powerful and they defy God, you know what God does? Number one, first of all, he laughs at them for being so deluded, and then he destroys them. 1 John 2 says that this world, in all of its opposition to God, is passing away, but that the person who does the will of God lives forever. And those who shun this world for the sake of faithfulness to Christ will live forever. In the words of Hebrews 13, here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come. And trust me, when you read the Bible's descriptions of our eternal future with all of the feasting we're going to have, and wealth and beauty and pleasure and fulfillment, it makes King Ahasuerus, it makes King Ahasuerus' party look like some catch-up in a prison cafeteria. Imagine you go back in time from this morning about 100 years, and you find yourself alone in the middle of the ocean. And then two boats happen to come by at the same time, and you get to choose which one you're going to go with for your rescue. And the first one is a small, slightly beaten up looking old fishing boat. And it's strong. You can see it's strong, it's seaworthy. It's got basic ample supplies in it, but it needs a lick of paint. Not built for luxury, it's pretty cramped. Probably a bit smelly from the engine puttering away and the smell of the fish. And you realize that if you go on board that one for your rescue and join it, that's going to be a lot of hard work until you reach port, because you're going to be helping the fishermen. Then you look at the other vessel. The other vessel is nearly 200 feet tall. It is nearly 1,000 feet long. It has a displacement of over 50,000 tons. It looks amazing. You probably know where I'm going with this. But you can see through the portholes that on board it has movie theaters and swimming pools and dining rooms and ballrooms with bands playing and luxury cabins. It's incredible. And you're just about to make the obvious choice when you notice the name painted on the stern of the other vessel, Titanic. That's what we're talking about here. So what does it look like practically for us not to be overly impressed by this world, taken in by its apparent glory? Let me tell you briefly about the great C.T. Studd, 1860 to 1931. Born into a very wealthy, powerful family, he received the best education money could buy. He was an elite sportsman with an international career. It's cricket, actually. There's not enough cricket happening in Knoxville. Let me just put that out there. C.T. Studd moved in the elite social circles of his day. And then to top it all, he inherited the equivalent of over $5.5 million in today's money. He had the world at his feet. He was smart, wealthy, talented, popular. He could have been anything and done anything he wanted. Now, he had a conversion experience to Christ when he was about 18. He then drifted back into living for this world. And then when he was 24, 6 years later, his brother, who he loved, he was very close to, became very seriously ill. And it looked for a while like he might die. And that really shook Studd to his senses. And he later recalled grappling with the question, quote, "What is all the fame and flattery worth when a man comes to face eternity?" And he went on to admit to himself, "I knew that my sport wouldn't last, and honor wouldn't last, and nothing in this world would last, and that it was worthwhile living for the world to come." And so what he did was he gave away the entire 5.5 million, donated the entire inheritance, all of his money. He walked away from all of those privileges. He spent the rest of his life as a missionary, dying in Africa many years later after bearing incredible fruit when his health eventually gave out. He wasn't perfect. He was flawed like the rest of us. But he did know what it meant not to conform to this world, not to be overimpressed by it or intimidated by it or seduced by it or envious of it. And we're not all called to do exactly what he did. Maybe some of us are. Don't want to discount that. But we are all called not to be taken in by the cotton candy of this world's prestige and power, and instead to joyfully pour our time and our money and our energy into living lives for Jesus Christ instead. Doesn't look impressive, but it is to back, to do that is to back the real winner. And that brings us exactly onto our final point, which is a truly pathetic king. And this is where some of the humor comes in. After an apparently powerful kingdom in 1 to 9, now we see a truly pathetic king. And this is verses 10 to 22. This point is briefer. Let's do a quick profile on King Ahasuerus. So verse 10, not in control of himself, probably drunk. At verse 11, he wants his supermodel wife to appear before him in her crown so that he and his drunken buddies can lust over her. And the text isn't entirely clear. Possibly he wanted her to be wearing only her crown. Verse 12, she's like, no thanks. And he loses it. He loses his mind. He throws a fit like the big baby he is because he doesn't get his way. Anyone here respecting him yet? Is the kind of king you guys would like? I know you guys are a little triggered by kings and that. There are some good ones, but maybe not King Ahasuerus anyway. I won't say that on July the 4th, don't worry. Verses 13 to 15. So in the middle of his big baby temper tantrum, he summons his Supreme Court to know what to ask and what to do. In 16 to 18, his Supreme Court, this is maybe a little over their pay grade, but hey, he's the king. They paint this, to be honest, ludicrous picture of all the other wives hearing about his wife standing up to him, copying her example, and then this same marital breakdown that he's had becoming endemic across the empire. There'll be anarchy, they panic. So verses 19 and 20, after much flattery and sort of oily telling him what he wants to hear, they come up with a plan. And the plan is for him to sack his wife, replace her with an upgrade, and then pass a law that every husband in every family across the entire vast empire
be in charge of his household.
That's not describing the beautiful biblical complementarian model throughout scripture of how godly husbands lead their wives by laying down their lives for them sacrificially. No. This law is pushing for the same kind of knuckle-dragging domination that the king pathetically tried and failed at with his own wife. Like, what a loser. How could you get a bigger loser than this? We should be laughing at him. When I was at elementary school, I remember going along to the photography club a few times. And sometimes it involved messing around with negatives. In other words, those, do you know what I mean? Those black and white versions of photos in the olden days on strips of film, in which the colors are all the opposite way around to the actual final photo. So that the light bits in the real photo appear dark in the negative, and the dark bits in the real photo appear light in the negative. How can we view this portrait in Esther 1 of such a pathetic, unattractive, impotent, unimpressive king without our minds going to his diametric opposite, the one and only true King of Kings? Where King Ahasuerus threw a party to display his own glory, King Jesus always did everything he did for the glory of his Father. Where King Ahasuerus was slave to his own appetites, his own physical appetites, King Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, "Yet not my will, but yours be done," and was then able to walk the walk as he went to the cross. Where King Ahasuerus was happy to try and exploit and humiliate his wife for his own ends, King Jesus laid down his life for his people, who the Bible calls his bride, out of his selfless compassion and love for her. Where King Ahasuerus cast his wife out the second she let him down, King Jesus says of his bride in John 6:37, "Whoever comes to me, I will never cast out." Where King Ahasuerus was terrified of anarchy breaking out in his kingdom if the same marriage failure he had started to spread, King Jesus rules over a kingdom that Hebrew 12 tells us will never be shaken. Where King Ahasuerus couldn't command the respect of his own wife, the word contempt is repeated in the passage for a reason, King Jesus commands the respect and worship of countless millions from every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and will do forever. And where King Ahasuerus told husbands across his kingdom to follow his example by dominating their wives in the way he had tried to, King Jesus commands husbands across his kingdom to follow his example by leading their wives through tenderly laying down their lives for them, protecting them. Let's allow the grotesque, pitiful, laughable clown that is the loser, King Ahasuerus, point us, by contrast, like a photo negative, to his exact opposite, the incomparable King Jesus. Have you taken him as your king? He's a good king. He is a good king to follow. Have you repented of your sin, as Nick was urging us to earlier, and put your faith in his death to pay for it, so that you might go from the good-looking ship that's going down to the real deal? And if you have done that, are you truly living for him? And if not, what needs to change? Because he is worthy.